Storm Champ. In this episode, we talk to educator, scholar, artist, mother, and the host of the Hella Chingona podcast, Rosana Alvarez. I interviewed Rosana back at the end of March 2020. So depending on when you're listening to this episode, you'll notice we talk a little bit about the beginning of the social distancing for COVID-19. But for various reasons, it's taken me a bit to get this show published. But I was excited to talk with her, and I hope you enjoy the show, and I will see you on the other side. Hey, Rosana, welcome to Storm Champ. Thank you so much for your time tonight.
Hey, I'm glad to be here.
So I'm super excited to finally talk to you. I was so proud that you got your podcast launched, the Hella Chingona podcast. You and I have been talking about that for a little while now, and I was kind of poking you a little bit to get it out the door, and I'm so happy to finally see you get it out there. One of the things that I love about your podcast, and I'm going to steal it, and I told you a little bit about this on the messages, but the first question you asked your guest is absolutely compelling, and I need to hear your answer. So tell me, who do you carry?
Yeah, that's a question I came up with a while back for class. And so as long as you always credit me when you ask
Absolutely.
It, steal away.
Yep.
There's a quote, I think it was Lalo Alcaraz, that says, you can steal my work, but don't steal my credit. And yes, that was me totally stalling for my answer.
There you go.
You would think that as much as I ask it, that I would have it at the ready. But it changes all the time. And I think it really reflects where we are, like, at any given moment when you're asked that question. So in this moment that is so beyond normal, I carry the people that are with me every day in quarantine, being my three babies for sure. And I always have them at the front of my mind, right? Just because they're that immediate next generation for me. And a huge part of my story and who I carry with me all the time is also my extended family. And so I grew up in a Mexican household, and it's weird to call them my extended family, but it really is my siblings, my parents. And I always have my grandmothers in mind.
Sure.
And I think that for me, that has a huge hand in who I am in the world. And so even when I don't have them in the front of my mind, they're a constant why, not just for what motivates me, but just who I am and who shaped how I exist in the world and the questions that I think to ask and even the way I talk, right? And so I think that a beautiful part about this really crappy time in our collective history is how much we kind of have to take stock of what's immediately at the ready. That's and it. So I see so many people connecting online right now, and all these challenges kind of popping up everywhere. Like, you know, I'm going to challenge you to collect the most beautiful pictures you see on my Instagram feed. Yeah. And as much as that seems like it's not related to the question of who do I carry, it really just forced me to take stock of, like, what are the things that I appreciate about people? And how is that reflective of the community that's always with me in every single space that I occupy, in every chair that I show up in, to be at a table or to be kind of just locked outside the door in any decision-making process? Like, just thinking about all of those things really has me appreciating that collective fabric of who has created my unique perspective in the world, because it really, what makes it unique is that it's such a beautiful combination of so many people that kind of just comes at you by way of Rosanna, but it's so much more than that, right?
Absolutely. So, and for context, like, you're the oldest of a big family. Like, how many siblings do you have?
I have eight siblings.
Okay.
So I'm the oldest of nine. And, you know, the youngest born when I was 18. And so there's a huge age gap there. And at the same time, I feel like having to always care for that many people makes you notice certain things about the world.
Absolutely. So the oldest of nine. Sure. Yep. You're the oldest of nine. You grew up in East San Jose, California, which for folks that aren't aware, that's like the Bay Area of California by San Francisco. What was it like growing up in such a big family in a predominantly Latino community? And how did you navigate those kind of things? And we're talking like context. I think this is the 90s, right, at this point, into going into the 2000s, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So a student just tagged me on this Instagram page that they saw Latinas growing up in the 90s. And I'm like, who stole my high school pictures? Because they're pretty on point.
Yeah.
So growing up in the 90s in East San Jose, I want to say it was different from how it is now, but in a lot of ways it's not, right? And so the great thing is I work not too far from where I grew up. And so a lot of the students that come through my spaces live in the neighborhoods where I grew up. And so the fashion might have changed, but it seems like a lot of the narratives about what it means to grow up a Latina in East San Jose in that particular neighborhood behind what used to be JW Fair, for folks who know that area, most folks might not, is that it was this very tight-knit community. And so we played with kids in the neighborhood. It was pretty diverse, but there were a lot of Latino families. And so for me, growing up as a Latina in a large Mexican family might be different from somebody who grew up in the Midwest, but there's a lot of similarities, right? And so one of the things that comes up for me is just having met one of my comadres when we were in sixth grade and going to her house and seeing that my family wasn't weird because we had, yes, rice and beans, but we also had flour tortillas. Yeah. Or some nights we would have, you know, meatloaf. And so for me, my experience is always kind of in that bridge middle space of And so a lot of people say, you grew up Mexican-American, so you're not from here and you're not from there. And I'm like, yeah, but all the same questions that folks would ask about that experience always felt weird to me, because you had folks saying you're part Mexican, part American, and that never felt right. And then you had folks saying this is what it means to be Mexican American, and that didn't feel right. And then you had folks saying this is what it means to be Chicana, and that felt a little bit more right. But then I think when it felt really right was when I kind of just got to connect with different folks who had that experience, whose values were very similar because the questions were very similar.
So remind me again, what generation are you? Are you your first generation?
So that's one of those tricky questions, yeah. Right? That's one of the tricky questions, like number one in that in-between of the in-between space.
Right.
And so when folks say, what generation are you? I'm always like, well, it depends on what your framing is of the question, because a lot of folks will say, first generation, my dad was an immigrant, and that'll suffice. Mm-hmm. But for me, it feels off because I also know that my mom was born here and her mom was born here.
Oh, interesting.
And her mom was born here. So we're kind of like first generation, but not. And then interestingly enough, every woman in that lineage also was married to a Mexican immigrant. Except for my great-grandmother, right? And I think when you get that far back, you start getting into those tricky bits of our collective history of when was he here. So I'm trying to figure out the question, and it really depends on who's.
So I think, but which part do you identify more with? And I ask this because like I'm in the same boat. Like my grandmother was born in Mexico, but my grandfather's side, like I'm fourth generation on my grandfather's side, right?
Right.
And so like, which part do you identify with more?
I feel like growing up, I was taught to identify with being Mexican, and that was it. But once I hit college, it was like, well, that always didn't feel quite right, right? If I had the paletero coming through the neighborhood and saying, hey, güerita, and I'd look at myself and I'm like, well, I'm not that güerita. What does that mean? And I knew that I didn't get to spend, you know, every December and every summer in Mexico like some of my cousins did. And I always kind of was, accidentally, because I don't feel like I ever felt less Mexican, but I knew people were trying to make me feel less Mexican than even some people in my own family. Mm. And so I identify with that Mexican part of me. You know, I met my husband at the Mexican baile. But at the same time, I know there are some parts that I can't even quite call American culture, but Chicano culture, definitely. So that's why I always kind of say in that middle space of that middle space.
So how do you, for people that don't know, that are listening, like, how do you define being a Chicano or a Chicana? If you don't
that's
know,
like a whole course.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Right.
What's the 60-second answer?
I know my 60-second answer really is that it has to do with a certain, not just your cultural lineage or heritage or what you grew up identifying as or being identified with, but it really has to do with this this awareness and acknowledgement of a certain history that's a little bit more complex than us and them and Mexico versus U.S. It's complex and it includes a lot of but the bridge, right, between both. And there's a lot happening on the traffic of that bridge of what it means to be Mexican and not quite American, but to part of the collective fabric of both.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So if you, how do you, so I grew up in the Midwest and that really wasn't a thing, like being Chicano or Chicana. That was like people that in California did those kind of things, right? Like we were, right. We didn't grow up that way. So how, as part of growing up and part of like figuring out who you were and how you identified, like how much did that influence you as you grew older?
I think that the labels that we put on how we identify, for me, it kind of came later and it started to matter more later. Mm. And so growing up, like I said, right, always Mexican. I knew that I was Mexican, but I was also a particular kind of Mexican. And I've gotten a good glimpse into how different parts of the nation relate and don't relate to the experience of identifying as Chicanos. And so a lot of that, I think, has to do with how different regions were impacted by certain histories, even along collective ways of identifying. And so I'm one of those folks who, you know, if I meet someone and our experiences are similar and they say to me, I'm Mexican, and I know that they were born here and grew up here in the United States, I don't ask them to modify according to how I identify. Sure. I feel like people should be identified and called what they connect to. And for me, being a Chicana from East San Jose, I feel like we were immersed in a particular culture that has a lot of similar threads that people can maybe connect to, even growing up in the Midwest. But that for me, it carries a particular distinction in the spaces that I'm in. And if I ever move to the Midwest, that might change, right? Because context is everything. And so for me, the context of where I am and the work that I do, and knowing that I also teach in Chicana studies and Chicano studies, that there is a lot that's being called out even in a 60-second version of why I identify that way. But it's also a lot that I don't expect other people to absorb or even relate to if they don't, right? Sure. Because there's always going to be some element of connection.
So as
and what you call it might be different.
Sure. So as an educator now and teaching those kind of subjects and knowing, like you mentioned earlier, the styles might be a little different, right? They might not be using as much AquaNet nowadays, right? But what kind of patterns are you seeing in like the youth of today that are similar or are different than what you saw growing up?
So first, do me a favor, and you can say whatever you need to me later, but on this side, I'm not getting the video from you.
Okay.
And that's fine if it's not going to work out, but it would help. Yep.
Can you still hear me, though?
I can hear you.
Oh, that's weird.
For sure.
Let me try this.
So right now on this side, I get the circle.
What about?
There you go.
Oh, okay.
Perfect. Okay. Yes.
And sorry it still about has
the thing on the top.
Cool.
No, no, it's fine. But that question, all I remember was Aquanet.
Yeah. So, you know, as an educator now and, you know, seeing how kids are today or, you know, young adults are today, what kind of patterns are you seeing that are similar or different than what you experienced kind of from that same area? And I think just for some context, so you, because the university that you teach at, there, a lot of, it's like more of a commuter type school, right? So more of the people from that area are going to it as opposed to like schools in the Midwest where you end up going away to school for, you know, you're driving a couple hours away or maybe some states away. So I think that the kids that go there are really kids from the area still, right?
Interestingly enough, that's not necessarily true. It's less of a commuter school these days.
Oh, interesting.
So we've got a pretty interesting mix. And in that way, for sure, it's changed.
That's good, actually. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. So some of the common threads that we're still seeing, and I think this goes to a lot of folks, not just from the Bay Area, but from California, because we have a very particular flavor too, is that that commitment to community. And I think in that sense, that commitment to community is constant. And how people activate around certain identities, communities at the core. And so a lot of why I ask that opening question, even with my students, of who do you carry with you, is it allows you to acknowledge fully who you are in the space. And so a lot of my students, whether they're from the Midwest or from our backyard here in San Jose, a lot of them are carrying expectations as first-generation college students in their families. And a lot of them are carrying a lot of weight on their shoulders in that sense of failure is not an option. And when failure is not an option and you don't have the same level of resources as privileged and or second, third, fourth college-generation students, how do you navigate all of that? And I think that that runs constant.
You know, what's interesting to me is like, you know, I think about conversations that I had in college, you know, 20 something years ago. And, you know, we were all talking the same thing about like first generation students. Like when does the first generation stop? Like that's what's, I guess, is immigration at such a peak still that it's still constantly first generation students going through this?
You would think, but I think that we're also seeing a lot of first generation college students who aren't necessarily first generation culturally.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay.
And so, yeah. And even in my family, I have family members who like across, you know, my current generation, cousins, if you will, who haven't gotten through that barrier yet. And you've got a range of us, right? And so whether it's on my mom's side or my dad's side, I think college as a pathway is important. And at the same time, I also see that these different career pathways are equally important in our society. And so I think it just depends, right? It's not just about immigrant trajectory and that first generation weave in for a college student. There's a lot systems wide that either opens access or makes that decision even an option in someone's life that isn't always just tied to immigration status or generation or timeline.
What's your thoughts on different opportunities aside from college?
I think that, you know, I come from a large family and not all of us chose to go to college, or some, my brothers in particular, might have chosen to go and then didn't finish. And so I think that it's really challenging to be in my seat and believe firmly in education and also know that I work both in a university setting and a community college setting.
Sure.
And know damn well a lot of grownups who outperform me in terms of salaried ranges and whatnot because they picked a different pathway. And so, case in point, I always reference Michael Madredzana, who, if you looked at her as a statistic, there are a lot of things that you can weave and assume about her story. But fact is, she makes way more money than me selling insurance, right? And so, and she didn't go to college, and college wasn't even an option for her because a lot of what happens in terms of push out. And so I'm one of those folks who, even though you would assume that I'd push for everyone to get an education, I think that we're in a time where, yes, I'm going to still push you to do that, and at the same time honor folks' decisions to choose a different pathway. Because not everything requires college, and yet college is increasingly important. So we're in this interesting space and time in that sense. And then you add on the layer of what's happening right now with this pandemic. And it's kind of like all bets are off. We don't know what any of this means moving forward. And hopefully there is a forward, right?
What's that been like for you as a, as an educator, kind of navigating this pandemic?
It's been driving me nuts. And it's been driving me nuts, not because we're trying to shift everyone online and what does that mean in terms of how you set up a course. Like, I'm comfortable moving things online. I've taught online for a while. The weird thing is seeing folks trying to support each other, missing the mark on our collective humanity. And so I think that's a constant thread. Even in all the questions you're asking me right now, I look back and I'm like, you know, it's really about connection and humanity and being able to weave into each other's stories regardless of where we're at. And so right now I'm looking at a lot of colleagues and I'm like, I have to hit the mute button on some of these groups I got added to by folks who either thought I could benefit from the resources or by folks who thought I had something to offer into those spaces. And I've kind of just hit mute, and I'm like, as much as it pains me not to tap into that generous spirit that I am in general and to hold back in that sense, I also see this kind of, I don't know if it's a coping strategy with folks swarming in defensively about what they're doing and not doing, but I think there are a lot of folks who are feeling very vulnerable and insecure right now. And I'm feeling that, just not so much in a way that's attached to my work. I'm feeling that just as a human being, you know, and feeling like there's a lot of uncertainty right now.
Sure, sure. So I had this whole conversation with one of our co-creators yesterday on StormChamp, and she was mentioning how she feels a pressure to do something creative, like different, different kind of pressure right now to get something in the world because, you know, so many people are doing it. Are you seeing that as well? I mean, it kind of sounds like you're seeing that as well, except the intentions are good, but the execution sounds like it's could be better.
Right. And the thing is, I kind of dabble in both worlds all the time. Like, even before all of this happened, I can relate to that sense of urgency, right? To want to make a mark on the world, to want to leave something behind and not knowing where you yourself are. And so I feel like that's a heightened urgency for a lot of folks. A lot of folks want to just automatically activate the list of some days right now. And I'm kind of like, but we also need to grieve. Like, for crying out, who, as silly as this sounds, she's not going to have an eighth grade promotion. I have a fifth grader. She's not going to have a fifth grade promotion. And those sound like dorky things right now to be upset about. And it's not so much that I'm mad or angry. It's that I'm sad for them. And I think that that's the most tangible way for me to just really grieve what impact this might have on them in the long term. That has nothing to do with productivity or output. And I think that part of the struggle of having so much access to each other during this time across, you know, platforms is folks are seeing in a different sense of urgency what everyone else is doing. And so, of course, you're going to see me throwing down some oil pastels at night or like having time to take pictures of some things I'm already working on because that's one of the hats I wear in the world. One of the feathers in my copili is just really always creating, which now people are also having a heightened awareness that there are people around them who have always been creating because they have time to take a look, right? And so it's a lot coming together at the same time in a time and space where folks are feeling that it's a collective anxiety. And I feel like creativity is kind of this coiled up energy that needs an outlet. And so you have a lot of people with pent up everything right now that are looking for an outlet that's going to make this better. And I don't think there is that one thing that's going to make this better for everybody. So I keep saying people need to chill out.
Yeah.
And it sounds like I'm being a hypocrite because I rarely am seen chilling out. And you look at my feeds and you're like, when does this girl sleep even during normal times?
Right, right.
And so I get that collective pressure that must put on other people too, right? But I'm like, we need a chill.
The idea of grieving is really interesting. Tell me, like, what does that mean at a time like this? Like, what does grieving look like?
I think grieving looks differently to different people, right? I think for some of my students, even it manifests like a series of, I'm just going to call it what it is, dumb questions. Mm. And I know a lot of folks like to say there are no dumb questions, but I think there are. And I myself ask a lot of dumb questions, especially when I need reassurance.
Right. Yeah.
And so there are things that I know, but I'll still ask them because they bring me comfort.
Sure.
And so I think that's a part of the grieving process that gets overlooked. I think that as frustrating as it is to see some of my colleagues wilding out on each other, that's part of the grieving process. Might not be the healthiest process, but it's a process. Mm. You know, my neighbor throwing a wrench in my schedule this afternoon, blasting his gangster rap, and I couldn't find a quiet spot to do this. That's a grieving process, you know? So I think that a part of that urgency to want to have these creative things out in the world is that grieving. If we could just replace all of this fear and uncertainty with something tangible that looks nice or feels good, then we can get past the grief.
So what do you, I'm sorry, go ahead.
It's complex, right? Yeah. I think grieving is a space we're all in right now. And part of that is everybody wants to connect with you on Zoom and, you know, so it's multifaceted for sure.
How are you getting your kids through this? Like, what are you telling them?
It's interesting because we kind of had a week lead in terms of the timelines we've had here in the Bay Area. And San Jose State was like, we're going to take a week. And this was before like the mandate started coming out saying people need to take time off of work. Mm-hmm. And then people need to force shutdown from life. So they were going to school. And then a week later, it was like, just kidding, they're not going to school. And then that's when we saw the ripple effect of everything kind of coming to a stop and a close while still expected to go and produce.
Right, right.
And so self-care has always been this thing that I've chased, right? As much as other people are chasing creativity right now, I'm chasing stillness and not having gotten there. And I don't know that I'll ever fully get there, but I'm going to keep chasing it. So for my kids, it looks like, you know what? There's all this stuff you could have done last week. You can go ahead and do absolutely nothing. And so I let them veg out and I let them be on their devices, and I'm sure I can get all kinds of judgment left and right, but I was like, you know, we all have our coping strategies. Why am I going to force them into this fake normalcy for the sake of feeling like we're being productive through this when we don't know what the next part of this story is going to look like? And I think that for me, that was an intentional choice. Mm-hmm. And even now, right, today was the first day of official online instruction for them. And last week should have been the first week of official online instruction for my grown-up students. And I was just like, y'all need time. Your lives are markedly different from what you expected them to be. And we can either all plug and play into this culture of productivity, or we can kind of just take a collective breath wherever we can in whatever spaces we can get, knowing that I'm probably not the norm in that entire week for them, my kids included, right? And so I just let them be and do and make their own choices about it without imposing any restrictions. You know, aside from the general, this is how you're going to stay safe and no, you can't go outside. And yes, you still have to shower. Kind of stuff.
So why has stillness been so elusive for you?
I think for me, it's when you, again, grow up in that culture of your parents worked really hard, so you kind of owe it to do right by their story. It just feels, I don't want to say it feels wrong, but it feels like they worked hard, so I shouldn't shy away from working hard. And that's one layer. And I feel like I've made a lot of gains and growth with that layer. And I'm able to put that little layer aside and say, I see you, I hear you. They also worked so hard, so hopefully I wouldn't have to.
Right.
And then knowing that for a while I worked hard as a habit because economic necessity, right? Post Great Recession or whatever folks want to call it. And then also knowing that I'm one of those personalities that if I'm still for too long, there's a lot of stuff going on in my head. And so it's still going to find its way out. And right. So for me, it's like quiet and stillness has still looked productive to other people because there's something that comes out of it. But at the same time, that quiet stillness is kind of my own mental health, my mental state of being able to tune out. Right. And so for me, that it's going to be elusive, but it's still, I'm going to keep chasing it in that way until I can learn how to not just tune my mind out, but also be able to sit in a chair and drink coffee and not, you know, be planning or plotting or creating even.
Right. Yeah. So as somebody who was very much like you, couldn't find stillness and then finally found it and it has become a practice, I will promise you, keep going. It's worth every heartache to get there. I promise you it's worth it, especially for minds, I think, that are similar and that never turn off. You got to get there. It's because it will open your up. It'll open up your mind in a different way. And it's amazing. So keep going.
And I think it comes in waves, right?
Sure.
Because I don't think it's always been completely elusive. I think it's more of a dance.
Oh, yeah,
and,
sure.
And yeah.
Sometimes a dance every second.
We'll get there and it's like, oh, this is nice. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, I'm like, "Ooh, now I have 7 projects that came out of that stillness." So I kind of just have learned to analogize it like this ongoing dance.
So let's talk a little bit about the podcast. Like, tell me a little bit about what drove you to finally create it and what do you hope to give the world with it?
Right. So the podcast, I've been on that idea for a while. It's one of those things that takes up a lot of mental space, idea space, heart space. And I have a lot of conversations with beautiful people in the world. And they always feel so healing. And sometimes we all gather collectively and we're like, why is this not a thing? And it's when you really think about it, not everyone has that in place for a variety of reasons that I think we're all feeling in this moment right now, right? We're all this culture of busy. And so not everyone will take the time or feels like they can take the time to have these conversations in that way. So there's that. And there's the piece of feeling like locally, we have a lot of rich history in terms of women's stories in particular that is just so damn hard to find. Even as an educator in a college space, we haven't been able to document those stories in a way that's sustainably accessible. So there's that. And then for me, it's how can I make it so that the next generation of folks, instead of saying, I didn't know that or I didn't have that, can just find it somewhere. And so right now, it seems like the accessible space is this online platform of sorts. And a podcast does something by way of capturing someone's story, not just in black and white on paper, but the cadence and the rhythm of their voice. And even that collectively carries so many people that created that unique voice in the world. And so even how someone pauses in their stories or, you know, there's folks who, when you talk to them, they say, you sound just like your sister. If I close my eyes, it's like I'm talking to your sister. And as silly and annoying sometimes as that sounds, there's a truth in it. And it's because we are in that way, reflections of each other. And so the podcast for me is just, how do I hold all these stories in a way that can be accessed and in a way that can be on record, right? Like archived.
Sure.
And so, and I sat on that for a good while. It's been years. And finally, I was like, you know, I can sit and perfect all damn day, and the stories are going to keep happening and the time's going to keep ticking. And even when I had the initial thought, I had already had all of these little tidbits of trauma in my life, of terms of like being afraid of loss and thinking about like, how long is my life actually going to be? And I'm also not a big fan of putting things off, because our time here is limited. And so what was it about this particular thing that I kept saying, I'll get to it and I'll get to it. And so finally, I felt like some of those traumatic things were getting closer to home in terms of within my own body, that I was like, all right, it's now or potentially never. Right. So progress over perfection. You say that quite a bit.
I do.
And yeah. And so I'm like, I'm just going to roll with it. Right. And do, because the stories are more important than the production quality. And if it helps one person, or if five people come across it, that's fine. Right. I'm not looking for a huge following. And I'm not looking to generate a whole lot from that other than a ripple effect. Yep. And so that I feel like I've already seen happen in the first few episodes. And I did let myself take a week off last week to grieve for our collective society. And I was like, you know, as giving as I am, we're going to take a pause. And so just seeing the positive response that I've gotten from folks being very generous with their feedback has already made it worth it.
Yep, absolutely. And just think about the gift you're giving your children and your grandchildren. I mean, I know, like, I would do anything to hear like my grandparents' voice or my father's voice, or, you know, voices I can't hear anymore.
Right.
And like years from now, they're going to be able to listen back to the audio or the video or whatever. And you're just going to, that's going to be such a gift to them that we don't really think about too often when we're kind of in the middle of doing this kind of stuff. So, yep, you're going to help somebody with every episode, but guess what? You're going to help your family even more, because they're going to be able to hear, like you said, their tone, how they paused, how they took a breath, all the ums that they said, right? Like, that's such a, such a gift for it all. So, kind of wrapping up a little bit here, where can people find you?
People can find me everywhere. I'm easily Googleable. No, but really, you can follow the podcast on Instagram, and that would be Hella Chingona Podcast. And for folks who don't know how to spell that, it's HellaChingona Podcast. And you can also find the website, HellaChingona.com. And if you're more about visual over the vocal here, then you can also find Heart of Rosanna. And my name is Rosanna on Instagram.
Awesome. Yeah. And we'll be sure to
see a glimpse into all those things.
Yeah. She's a great artist, by the way. Like, you should see her stuff. It's pretty amazing. And she posts stuff all the time. And I'm like so jealous, because I can't draw for the life of me. And I wish I could do that. But it's awesome. Yeah. Your artwork's great. The podcast seems like it's, you know, off to a great start. You've been really open and vulnerable with some things. And I'm like, wow, like, that's cool. That's cool that you're opening up about a lot of this stuff. And I think the world definitely needs that. So last question, this is my question that I love asking people. It's what's the legacy you want to leave on the world?
Right. So the legacy I want to leave on the world, I had an interesting talk on the podcast about that question. And somebody was like, I don't know if I would call it a legacy. And I'm like, I get you. Right. And I think it's more legacy beyond that space of ego. Right.
Sure.
But it's always like, I think about even with my college students, when I do teach public speaking, and I'm like, doesn't matter what you say, you always want to leave that little thumbprint, that little mark, that little thing for folks to either not so much remember you by, but to activate toward, right? And so for me, leaving a legacy is just really about, how do I invite folks to activate their own potential? And because my work is so multifaceted and I get myself into all of these mitotes, I'm looking for that collective thread. And I've been able to articulate it as embracing personal power through creative inspiration. And so in terms of a legacy, it really is that personal mission. And I think it does start even in my own household, in terms of how my kids have been described by so many people as being so free. And I kind of want that for people, right? And I might not inspire you to do that. That's not what I'm here to do. I'm here to invite you to spend time with yourself so that you could figure out what is that thing that makes you tick? What is that thing that makes you want to sit in stillness with yourself and activate that collective story of everybody you carry with you? And so the legacy I want to leave behind really is that. It's just inviting people to spend time with themselves to fully activate so that they can embrace their personal power and hopefully tap in through that, into that by way of some creativity. Whether you draw or you know how to sit in stillness, that's an art in itself. Absolutely. Right?
No, that's awesome. Yeah, and I think you're off to a great start. I think between the podcast, your artwork, the things that you're doing in the world, and just I think you have such a unique position because you can influence young minds and being able to teach them at such an early age. Like, you got it. Just go, right? And figure out what that thing is and run and, you know, do so unregretfully. And so keep doing what you're doing.
And to trust yourself in that process. Absolutely. Right? Trust yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah. Rosanna, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being on the show tonight. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again, Rosanna, for taking the time to come on the show. Be sure to check out our website at stormchamp.com. There you'll find links to all of our past episodes, as well as links to the podcast platforms that we are on. And if you enjoyed the show, please be sure to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. That would really help us boost the visibility of the show. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll check you later.